The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 122, Panel Discussion, From Persecution to Outreach, the Evolution of Mormon Attitudes Towards Community Service, with moderator Ted Wilson, panelists Terry Cisneros, Scott Lechman, and Richard Reese.
To start on time, so I'm going to try to stick to that rule if I can. My name is Ted Wilson. I'm your moderator today. By way of quick personal introduction, I'm the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. I've had a fair amount to do with community service, and so I'm delighted to be moderating a panel that focuses on community service and the LDS Church and sort of the evolution of that particular thing. I'd like to introduce the panelists to you here this morning. First of all, Terry Shields Cisneros. Terry is from Utah. She is a graduate of Tooele High School and the University of Utah, we're very proud to say. She did her work in health and sociology. She is a program coordinator at the Lowell Benyon Center for Public Service, which has been a tremendous addition to the University of Utah. Has given many, many people an opportunity to become involved. And I don't want to take any more of her thunder away from her, so I won't say much more on that. She became involved as a student volunteer, as many of the staff at the Benyon Center have, and then went on to the staff, and she's been a staff member for 2 years. She worked with recovering addicts, particularly women, in her time there and helping them become closer to their children as they recovered from their addiction. So Terry will have a lot of good things to say in that particular area. If you don't know this man, you should. He spent several hundreds of thousands of dollars getting to know you all a little over a year ago.
It wasn't enough.
But he's a tremendous guy, Dr. Scott Lechman, as wonderful a conscience, I think, as I've ever met. This man cares about community service. He's given it for many, many years in many ways. He is a medical doctor, a surgeon. His wife is also a doctor, and the two of them have gone out of their way to do many things. Scott will tell you about some of this stuff today, but he has worked very closely with Muhammad Yunus, who you may have heard of, a Bangladeshi who developed the Grameen Bank, a microcredit bank, which in some people's estimation is worthy of a Nobel Prize, and we may see that for Muhammad Yunus someday. Scott's been to Bangladesh. He's worked with a group in America called Results, which has endeavored to bring microcredit not only to third world nations, but to instill it here in the United States of America among the poor, which is a concept which I think Scott will talk about. So, again, I don't want to steal his thunder. Scott, great to have you with us today. It should be Senator Scott, but I think if it were Senator Scott, he'd be here today anyway. That's the kind of guy Scott Lechman is. Wouldn't be back there cooling his heels in Washington like the rest of them. Rick Reese is with us. Rick is a dear old friend of mine. I've known him for, 40 or 50 or 60, 70 years. I don't know how long I've known Rick, but we climbed mountains together for many, many years. And Rick Reese did his PhD work in Columbia, where he had an unusual opportunity to see the service work of the Catholic Church in that area. And he'll be talking about this, I believe, today. Rick has done many interesting things over the years, including teaching at Carroll College in Helena, Montana. Went on to direct the Yellowstone Institute in Yellowstone National Park. He's been an advocate for the reintroduction of the wolf to the park, studied the bear and many of the flora and the fauna in the park, and directed that for many years. He's published the Utah Geographic Series, which is a wonderful series of books on Utah and its geography and its people. Rick is now the Community Relations Director at the University of Utah, where he serves to try to keep the university in good shape with the city council and other things, and fraternities, and all kinds of hassles. So he fulfills that role very, very well. Rick will talk about the Catholic Church and some observations. I think Terry is a member of the Mormon Church. Scott and Rick are not. We're fortunate to have some non-Mormons here today. I don't like non-Mormon. How do we say it? People who decided not to be Mormons at an early date. I don't like the title non-Mormon. It tends to classify you by the title Mormon. A couple of Gentiles are here with us. By the way, it's the only place in America that you can be both a Gentile and a Jew at the same time. So neither of these folks are Jewish, however, so we won't get into that. And I left my introduction somewhere in my packet here. Let me just make a quick introduction, then go to our panelists. We'll ask them to take 10 minutes each or whatever they'd like. And then we'll come to questions from the audience. We only have an hour, so we'll move as quickly as we can. After the persecutions of New York, Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois, the saints, as you all know, came west. The value of consecration was deeply embedded in the early church, but it was mainly used by Joseph Smith and later by Brigham Young and other presidents of the church in the 19th century to support the institution. It was rarely used to provide direct charity person to person within the institution of the church. However, in the early days, informal bishop aid to poor individuals and families was prevalent, even though it was not necessarily institutionalized at the top level of the church. During the 19th century, poor people could go to the bishop and get a measure of the bishop's storehouse or other measures that were provided at the time. It was not until the 1930s, when Utah suffered about 33% unemployment in the middle 30s, that the church welfare system was established. Though the welfare system was internal and limited to church membership, it was the first real institutional attempt to organize throughout the church to help the poor on a regular basis, and did contribute momentum to the modern church, where there's been a dramatic expansion, in my view anyway, to Christian services in the community not necessarily associated with proselyting. And I think that's how you make a distinction. If someone's helping someone to get them into the church, it takes on a different hue than if there is a direct humanitarian outreach without that sort of caveat. Now, the LDS Church has contributed regularly to natural and human disasters. If you were to go today up to Riverdale, Utah, you would find the stakes and the wards deeply embedded in turning all of those people out with shovels. When I was mayor of Salt Lake City in 1983-1984, we depended on the Mormon Church very, very heavily to get people to the streets, to put up sandbags. A Christian, of course, has many stories to tell of that, as his wife was a council member at the time with me in Salt Lake City. I remember calling First Counselor Gordon B. Hinckley on the phone one morning and saying, "President, I've got a real problem. City Creek Canyon is about ready to bust loose," and my salesmanship then went on to say, "If it goes down around the corner, it'll go right into the church office basement where your computers are." I wanted him to have a real reason. You know, I shouldn't have done that because he probably would have responded anyway, and I didn't give him the opportunity to be a true Christian on this one. He laughed, and he says, "Ted, it's Sunday morning. I've got everybody out there in church." Oh, I say, "I know a few people that don't go. Maybe you could get there." We had a fun talk. And so he said, "Well, I don't know about this. I don't know if I can get people out of church. That's going to be really difficult, but I'll call you back in a few minutes." So I sat by my phone. We were really worried because we just didn't have the people power to stack the sandbags to keep the water where it ought to be on State Street instead of going into basements and homes and the other places it would go. And he called back in about 10 minutes, and he said, "The ox is in the mire, and we'll do what we can." Within 2 hours, I would guess 5,000 people appeared on State Street. And some were still wearing their church clothes. Some had gone home and changed, but some were wearing their formal, taking their ties off. And there those people rolled up their sleeves and went to work. It was unbelievable. And I remember, I get a little emotional about it even today, but I remember walking down State Street at 3 o'clock in the afternoon thanking these people as mayor, and they were all thanking me for getting them out of church that day. It was quite remarkable. So we love to see the system break down, don't we? We really do. I mean, people were quite energized by that, quite excited about that. And but ongoing now, a couple more Saturdays, a couple more critical Mondays and Tuesdays in the middle, the Mormon Church was on the street. So were the Catholics, and so were the Seventh-day Adventists, and so were many other churches. This was not just a Mormon deal. But the Mormon Church, of course, being the dominant church in this community, provided tremendous manpower. So in the sense of a natural disaster, the church has tremendous community instincts. And that not only would be the streets of Salt Lake City, but it's more recently food and clothing being shipped to Kosovo, food and clothing going to Biafra. You know the stories of lots of efforts being done as the Mormon Church has chosen to participate and airlift these supplies across the world. And again, this is, I think, community and not for proselyting reasons. Maybe in the long run, but in the short run, the church has had really no vested interest in direct sorts of benefits for themselves. The church has also had a tradition in this community, started by President N. Eldon Tanner, of supporting downtown development. The land that you're now sitting on is on a 50-year charitable lease from the church with no payment. The Salt Palace was built on church property. I think Alan Blodgett had a hand in that transfer of land back in the days when Alan was the church budget director. The church has donated property throughout this community for various community causes. The church has built infrastructure in downtown Salt Lake City. One is very controversial right now. The strip of land, which used to be Main Street, now looks like World War II, will at some point in the near future be a lovely garden space in the city. It is controversial, but I think the leadership of the church feels like that contribution is a community contribution. The church more recently, under the leadership of Elder Alexander Morrison, has extended community projects, at least to my knowledge, through the Utah North area, which includes most of the stakes in this valley and north of Salt Lake City. The church, in that regard, has asked the stakes to file public service plans and to have specific activities within the stake and within the wards where people go do charitable Christian service not associated with proselyting. Alexander Morrison has also been a force in providing charitable service in many specific areas, some of which will be talked about this morning. The mission program of the church has been greatly expanded in recent years to service missionaries, people to go out and work throughout the world. We have a friend in our ward, Kathy and I. By the way, my wife Kathy's back here. Raise your hand, hon. I want to introduce you because she's got a great art show just two doors down, and I want you to go there and buy an expensive painting for Sunstone's benefit, okay? The church has done a lot of work, and a couple in our ward is now serving in Russia, Charles Smart, and he's not just serving Mormons, he's serving people who need help. So I think the expansion within the missionary program to service missionaries has been a very helpful thing throughout the world. So we have seen, at least in my view, a definite trend towards more broad Christian service from a church that was once so persecuted and once so forced into isolation that it could only afford really to take care of its own. And maybe that tradition lasted too long. We could talk about that. But these people today will talk in these areas and we'll then engage your questions. Terry, would you begin for us?
Hi. Good morning. I have chosen to kind of keep my thoughts to something that I have been involved in quite a bit, and that has come from an influence of one man, and probably many of you in here would know a lot more about I do, and about Lowell Bunyan. But I've chosen to kind of direct my thoughts towards his influence in leading so many LDS people and organizations to thinking more about service. So I would love to stay after and talk to a few of you who knew Lowell personally and learn more of those stories. But as Ted introduced me, I was a student at the Lowell Bunyan Community Service Center, and I happened to just kind of bump into it my senior year, so I was almost done with school. And I had big plans to go on to graduate school and get a master's degree and be a health administrator and make a lot of money was my plan. I think my experience at the Bunyan Center, as well as a few service learning classes at the University of Utah, kind of directed my path towards something different. And I'd kind of like to talk a little bit about the path that I've gone through in the past few years and explain kind of how Lowell Bunyan's life and his legend of service to so many has kind of inspired me to do that for my work. After being a student at the Bunyan Center, I found myself graduated from the University of Utah with a job as the volunteer coordinator at the Utah Food Bank. As several of you may know, Lowell Bunyan was the director of the Community Services Council for about 16 years, I believe, and the Utah Food Bank is one of the many agencies that sits underneath the umbrella of the Community Services Council. In reading a little bit about his history and also through my experience at the food bank, I was able to learn a lot more about Lowell Bunyan's life and learned that he was pretty much responsible for the beginnings of the Utah Food Bank. And one of my favorite things to do with volunteers there was to take them on a tour around the food bank and talk to them a little bit about the history. And it was always fun to share stories of how Lowell Bunyan would go out, gather donations from several grocery stores in the area, and after they had given them what they had, he would ask them if he could look in their dumpster for anything that was damaged or ripped or something but still had its integrity and could be consumable for people. And so I always have this picture of a probably 67-year-old man rummaging around in the dumpsters and hopping in and out of them like he's maybe 20 years old. So that was really fun to be able to share those stories with people. And often I'd have volunteers there who would also share stories of their experience with Lowell Bunyan. After he would gather the food, a lot of times he would gather things and take it in his own truck and deliver that to several elderly people or he knew were in need of that food. And the food bank started as just a small room full of food. And today they distribute millions of pounds of food out of a warehouse and the entire state of Utah, as well as bleeding into Wyoming and Idaho, and I believe Nevada. And so that was kind of my second big introduction to Lowell Bunyan, but I also learned a lot more about him by being there. A year later, after I started my job at the food bank, I was given the opportunity to go back and work in the Lowell Bunyan Community Service Center. And I was so excited to be able to work with students and also work on several different issues that were in our community and get students excited about doing that. The way the Bunyan Center started, it's about 11 years old, and it was actually dreamed up, or the idea came from And a lot of the money came from one of Lowell Bunyan's former students. And he felt that his life had been impacted so much by what Lowell Bunyan had taught him that he felt like this would be a worthwhile thing to do at the University of Utah. And so it happened. And it started with one director and about eight students who would go out and recruit volunteers off of campus. And now it has grown into about 14 staff members and 80 students. And we probably involve about 6,000 volunteers from the University of Utah each year. And that's also through a service learning program on campus, which involves service as part of learning curriculum in the classroom. So students are able to apply something practical to the things that they're learning and see how that impacts the community. Through Lowell Bunyan's example and philosophies, thousands of people have been affected. Many of the students in the Bunyan are Mormon and many are not. In fact, it has been said, and this is a quote, by focusing on service and bridge building, the Bunyan Center sidestepped the Mormon, non-Mormon tension that affected many other arenas and activities on campus. Some of the students felt that the Bunyan Center may be the only place on campus where they don't have to worry about those relationships. So I think that's pretty neat. There are so many other LDS people and organizations who have influenced to serve by Lowell Bunyan's examples and his writings. I'd like to go on to share just a few of those that maybe tie into directly to the organizations of the church as well as to individuals. First of all, Lowell Bunyan was made bishop when he was in his 70s, and one of the things that he's known for in being bishop for 3 years was he would ask the youth of the ward to commit to one morning to go out and serve the needy in their own ward and then throughout the entire community of Salt Lake City. He also asked the same things of several of his students as he taught as an institute teacher for about 26 years. And that's where a lot of what the Bunyan Center's beginnings came from, was his teaching and example as an institute teacher. Another example, and these are from his Community Services Council days, came from Dick Winters, and this is a quote from him. Dick Winters is Lowell Bunyan's predecessor at the Community Services Council, and this is what he says. He says, the LDS Church's broadening outreach to the needy both in Utah and internationally as a response to Lowell's brand of Christianity, and kind of what Ted said, we take care of our own, that's being left behind. And he goes on to say, Lowell is an effective conscience of the church. And kind of in looking at this, you can see that after Lowell Bunyan was director of the Community Services Council, the church was supporting the Utah Food Bank in many major ways. It donated food and clothing to struggling Eastern European countries and also sent experts abroad to help evaluate needs. Starting in December 1991, fast offerings could now be designated for humanitarian aid. In 1963, modeled after his own Boy's Ranch in the Tetons, Lowell worked to establish a similar ranch in Salt Lake for boys who needed a place to live because they couldn't get along at home. After several pleas, he received a $10,000 grant from President David O. McKay's emergency fund to buy the property and build a ranch. The ranch still exists and provides education, clinical therapy, moral and spiritual values, and a home atmosphere for troubled boys, many of whom have no family or guardians. The final example that I have is through one of Lowell Bunyan's writings. The article is called Weightier Matters, and it was actually published in Sunstone about 23 years ago, and then later republished on BYU's campus, which led to change their student government from a student government to a student service organization on campus. and that happened about 5 years ago. In the article, he talks about several people he knows who, especially elderly people, who are living in poverty or who are lonely or isolated, and talks about our need as LDS people to step up and take care of them and do more as a church to make sure that people are being taken care of. And so I'd just kind of like to end my thoughts with that as a challenge, that we have come a long way, and many of us are doing service in our community, but there is always more to be done.
Thank you, Karen. Scott, you probably do it right there from your seat if you prefer. Can you all see Scott okay if he stays there? Okay. All right.
I got the booklet a few days ago with your program, and I kind of looked through the competition between 10 and 11, and I saw the topic eroticizing the ordinary. I thought, boy, we're in trouble. But we've got a good crowd despite that, and some people have come in late. I imagine they... I imagine that some of the people that came in late were in the other session, found out there were no pictures, and decided to come on over. And then I knew I was in trouble when I read about our panel discussion. I read the abstract, and I called Ted, and I just, boy, I don't know anything about that. And he said, that's fine, just talk about what you know. So this won't take too long. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. What I'd like to do is just kind of put things in perspective and then talk about the bad news and then talk about the good news. Let me start off by asking you a question. How many of you in here are rich? And I don't mean this rich in spirit stuff. I mean...
bucks?
Money, yeah, bucks. Cash, dinero. Okay. Well, let me give you four questions here and see how we do. This is called the affluence test. Number one, do you own more than one pair of shoes? Okay. Do you have more than one choice about what you will eat for each meal? Okay. Number three, do you have access to your own means of transportation? Okay. Number four, do you own more than one set of underwear? Now you can just answer this to yourself. You don't have to. Yeah. Okay, those four questions. Now, if you could answer yes to three of them, then you're in the top 10% of all the people who have ever lived. Okay, that's just three of them at any one time in your life. Then you're in the top 10%. Pretty amazing. Okay, today, what's poverty? What's the dimensions of poverty today? 1.3 billion of our fellow human beings are trying to get by on a dollar or less a day. 1.3 billion. So what's life like for people trying to get by with on less than a dollar a day? 35,000 children die daily. Largely from preventable causes. 35,000 children daily. Almost 600,000 women die annually in pregnancy and childbirth. Over 250 million children work, and many of them are at risk of from hazardous and exploitive labor. So a quarter of a billion children at risk in working as children. 130 million children of primary school age do not go to school. They don't even get to go to school, primary school. 130 million children. 2 billion people do not have access to children or malnourished. Now, that's the bad news. And again, those are statistics. And sometimes it's hard to let yourself actually consider those as real things. There have been great movements over time. I mean, the movement to end slavery, the civil rights movement, and you can come up with some of your own, and some that you may have participated in yourself. I myself am participating in what I think is going to be the greatest movement, certainly of my generation, if not of all time, and that's the movement to end poverty. I mean, actually end poverty. We're at a time in the history of humankind that we can actually end poverty. Now, when you look back in your life, there are sometimes events that happen that totally affect the rest of your subsequent life. And you never know when those things happen. For me, one of those events happened in 1985, and I was a surgery resident at the university, and I was invited to a meeting at the St. Paul's Episcopal Church. And so it was one of those events where, do I go home and get some sleep, or do I go to a meeting? And for some reason, I went to this meeting, and I met, there was a presentation there from a group called Results. And Results is a grassroots citizens' lobby whose purpose is to create the political will to end hunger and poverty. And so I went, because I was invited by a friend, and I listened to their spiel. And they talked about some of these statistics, and they talked about what can be done, that we have the technology, that we have the resources to end this unnecessary suffering, but that we just don't have the political will. And I was kind of aware of some of these things before that time, but I didn't know what to do. I, you know, was worried that I have to move to Africa or something, which would be very disruptive. But this group, they talked about things like educating yourselves on the issues, writing letters to the editor in the newspaper, meeting with editorial writers, meeting with your congressional representatives. And, you know, that sounded like fun. Sound like fun. So for the last 15 years, almost 15 years, I and a group here in Salt Lake and across the nation and in seven countries around the world have been doing this work of creating political will. And to tell you the truth, I think that creating the political will is actually just as important, if not more important, than the work I could be doing if I moved to Africa. So let me just talk about some of the things that can be done. One area that we lobby on is child survival activities. Again, I mentioned 35,000 children dying daily from largely preventable diseases. One thing we lobby for is immunizations. You know, funding immunizations through our foreign aid and have our foreign aid going to something that will help meet some of these basic human needs. And this has been a great success story worldwide, the impact of immunization. There are today 3 million children that survive each year because of expansion and immunization programs. And this has largely been done because of expansion of spending money on those programs. And again, when I started working on this, there were 5 million children dying of dehydration from secondary to diarrhea. You know, I mean, can you imagine if your child died because of diarrhea? And it can be prevented with a 10-cent packet of oral rehydration salts. That's all. And now, because of expansion of the availability of oral rehydration salts, there are now only 2 million children dying each year from diarrhea. So, still a lot of work to do, but boy, great things have happened in the last 15 years. One area that we've been very successful at is expanding the amount of money our government spends in our foreign aid for these sorts of activities, child survival activities. In 1984, the Child Survival Fund was just created. It was at zero. And today, more than $330 million is spent annually. So that's a lot of bake sales. And it's because people like you and I, you know, I called Jake Garn, met with him, asked him to co-sponsor this legislation. I went down to the editorial writers at the Tribune and the Deseret News, and they wrote editorials about it. They weren't sure what to do with me when I first showed up. But and so these are all simple things that we can do that collectively have a big impact. I mean, you never know exactly, you know, what action you do will make a difference, but collectively you know that they do. Another very exciting area that we've identified as being helpful in ending poverty is microcredit. Has anybody heard that term before, microcredit? Okay, so a few hands then. The idea here is to give loans mainly to women so they can start their own business and businesses, women living in poverty. And through my work with Results, I was able to meet Muhammad Yunus, who back in 1976 started a poverty lending bank in Bangladesh. And let me just tell you a little bit about his first borrower so you can see the power in this concept. He was a Bangladeshi economist. He was was a Fulbright scholar at Vanderbilt University, went back to Bangladesh to teach economics at a university there, just after their independence, for those of you who know that history. And the country, the economics of the country just got worse, worse, and worse. And the theories he was teaching out of his textbook just did not seem to matter. And he felt pretty useless. And he thought that if he could just help one person, then his life was worthwhile. And so he went out into a village near his university and just watched people to learn their economics. And he met a woman there named Sophia Khatun, and she made bamboo stools. Very skillful. Worked very hard. He was actually surprised at how hard people worked in the villages. And he asked her, well, how much money do you make a day? And she said, 2 cents. 2 cents a day. And he couldn't believe that. That was just... He was actually ashamed that he lived in a society where someone could work so hard and make only 2 cents a day. So he asked her, how is that possible that you can only make 2 cents a day? And she said, I don't have the capital to buy the bamboo. Thus, I'm dependent on a trader to give me the bamboo in exchange for the finished product at a price that he fixes. So that's her profit of only 2 cents a day. So he asked her, gee, if I loaned you some money, would you be able to take your finished product to market and sell it for more? And she said, well, of course. So he loaned her $6. Her income immediately went from 2 cents a day to $1.25 a day. And she became middle class. She's able to afford 3 meals a day instead of one. She was able to get a tin roof for her home to keep the rain out. She was able to send her daughter to school. All that was not happening because of lack of $6 in capital. So from that experience, he now has a poverty lending bank in Bangladesh, the world's largest experience. He He has 2.3 million borrowers. 94% of them are women. The repayment rate with interest, average initial loan is $25. After you pay back the loan over a year period, you're eligible for a larger loan after that. Loans now average like $167. Initial loans are about $25. And the repayment rate with interest is 98%. He loans out $500 million every year in these small loans. So, and he's making a small profit. And the borrowers have stock in the bank. They're the owners of the bank, these poor women of Bangladesh. So, huge success story. It's been replicated in 50 countries, and we're starting to do it here in the U.S. And so, over the last 15 years, I and my colleagues here in Salt Lake and 120 cities across the U.S. have been cheerleaders for this concept, educating our elected officials about it, telling them what they can do. And now, we, in our foreign assistance, give out about $70 million a year for microcredit programs because of lobbying that we've done. So, and these are all simple things. And actually, it makes you feel good because you're participating in the political system and you're doing your duty as a citizen to tell our elected people what concerns you about things that matter. Yeah. Yes, and actually this is a great thing because when you get involved in this sort of thing, you find all sorts of allies. And Warner Woodruff is a professor down at BYU, and he's been interested in microcredit for years. And they now have a Grameen support group there. And I've been able to speak down there a couple of times, and they have like over 100 students involved in this stuff, and they're sending them over to Bangladesh to get trained in how to do these loans, and yeah, it's wonderful, great interest. I've had, let me just wind up here by saying that I kind of consider this my little corner of the world, okay? And I'm kind of responsible for creating political will here. And so I've had some interaction with the LDS Church because they're the greatest political institution in the state. And so I've had interactions over the years, and I've found them very receptive, especially to the concept of microcredit. They've actually had, in earlier times, some bad experiences with loans. They gave out loans and had very poor repayment rates. And I think the reason that was is because of the connection between church and the idea of charity. People getting loans kind of thought that this should be charity, I think is the problem, as you can imagine. And charity's great. But it's a Band-Aid, and that's the great thing about microcredit is it's sustainable. All this money comes back and can be loaned out again. It regenerates, and so they're interested in. And so my vision was, boy, the LDS Church is everywhere. They're in a lot of poor countries. If they did microcredit, that would really help. Hopefully, the very big things are going to happen. Okay, this is was more than a decade old. This is former Senator Mark Hatfield. We stand by as children starved by the millions because we lack the will to eliminate hunger. Yet we have found the will to develop missiles capable of flying over the polar cap and landing within a few hundred feet of their target. This is not innovation. It is a profound distortion of humanity's purpose on Earth. And the last one I'll read to you is from the Progress of Nations report. It's put out by UNICEF, which is a wonderful organization. They're world leaders as far as child survival programs go. And they each year, back in 1990, they put on a World Summit for Children. And they thought that if we could set goals and get the attention of world leaders, that great things could happen. And we're going to fail on many of those goals next year. They were decade-long goals. But there are some that were going to be met. And obviously, more things were done as a result of setting these goals than if they weren't. But that's another topic. Anyway, in the Progress of Nations report, they say, the day will come when the progress of nations will be judged not by their military or economic strength, nor by the splendor of their capital cities and public buildings, but by the well-being of their peoples, by their levels of health, nutrition, and education, by their opportunities to earn a fair reward for their labors, by their ability to participate in the decisions that affect their lives, by the respect that is shown for their civil and political liberties, by the provision that is made for those who are vulnerable and disadvantaged, and for the protection that is afforded to the growing minds and bodies of their children. So I'll end there, but if you're interested in doing this sort of work, please let me know. Results has a website, www.action.org, and they have links there to some of these microcredit programs, too, if you're more interested in that. And then my email is lechman@xmission.com. So I'd be interested in your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. And Scott and his wife have adopted two lovely young boys from India, and Matt is here with us today. Matt, stand up and raise your hand, will you?
He's a real still character. Awake, which is amazing.
He's quite a guy. Rick, you get a choice of sitting there or coming up, whatever you'd like to do.
Easier for me to stand.
All right.
Well, I think we're running short on time, and I hope there will be some time for questions and answers. Following two politicians or former politicians is a daunting task, and so I'll try to make up for the remaining short time by abbreviating what I want to say. I'd like to start with a brief quote from a man named H.J. Phillips, who defined oratory of the type that you may be hearing here today. He says, oratory is the art of making deep noises from the chest sound like important messages from the brain. So I'll make a few deep noises from the chest and hope that it comes across to something from the brain. I would really just like to pose a couple of questions and maybe plant a couple of seeds. As you know, the LDS Church is involved in a significant new initiative in the area of community service. And I'm interested in why this new initiative is going forward. I'm interested in who the recipients of this community service are. And I think those are questions I don't have answers to, but I think they might be very interesting issues to explore, maybe in this group here in a few minutes. I presume, of course, that interest is aimed at the service to humanity in need, and indeed I think it is. A true concern based on concern of our fellow human beings. But I'm also interested in at least thinking about and exploring the question of what sorts of responsibilities does the church and any organization involved in community service, for those good reasons, concern about our fellow human beings, I'm very interested in what sort of responsibility the church may have in addressing the causes of the kinds of problems they're trying to deal with in their community service activities. The causes of hunger and homelessness and youth violence and other social ills that we're now organizing our community service efforts to try to deal with. We won't, for example, eliminate hunger, not in the world, but certainly not in Salt Lake City, with food banks. Something needs to change. The system needs to change. And the question I have is, what is the responsibility? In this case, we're talking about the church. What is the responsibility of the church to play some role in addressing the causes of the kind of problems we're so concerned about that cause the plight of our fellow human beings? Just one quick example. In last night's Deseret News, and even though I'm not a member of the church, I do read the Deseret News. My grandfather was editor of the paper for 15 years. I considered it a very good paper, especially on local issues. But there was an article in last night's Deseret News on the front page entitled, Utah Charities Feeling Heat. And it estimated that the impact on the Crossroads Urban Center feeding program would triple by the end of the year because of the so-called Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. Lots more people are going to be needing food here. It's a small example, but it's one, again, that I have to ask. I mean, it's the type of example that raises the question. If our community service programs are truly aimed at assisting people in need, might our effectiveness not be greatly enhanced by bringing some effort to bear on the causes of this need? I don't need to tell you about Jesus and the choice of giving people some fish or teaching them to fish. And I just think this new community service initiative raises all kinds of questions about whether or not the church might, for example, take a closer look at instances where they might bring their political clout to bear on the causes of the problem rather than dealing with the symptoms of the problem. So I have just one or two other things that I want to point out. There is, of course, within the Catholic Church in Latin America, and a number of you are very familiar with the history of the church, instances in which the greatest social change in many of these countries historically has come from clergy. I returned just yesterday morning from Guanajuato, Mexico, which is the cradle of the independence movement in Mexico, where the Spanish priest Miguel Hidalgo launched the Mexican War of Independence. And Hidalgo was concerned, among other things, about the slaves that the Spanish had working in the mines. And they were wondering how on earth they could help these people. And yes, you could have a feeding program and take a food basket every day, but Hidalgo included, no. No, the way to do this is independence from Spain. The way to do this is, in this case, revolution. So I guess the thing I'd like to leave you with is, again, this question of what role do we have in making the socioeconomic and political system itself more just and less likely to spawn the kinds of human needs that we now seek to fill through community service programs.
Could you repeat the question? Did you
ask the question? Okay. Does microcredit work with people who are starving? As far as Africa goes, there's a number of programs there that are working, that are up and going. I know that Finca is in Uganda. I'd have to get on my, internet and track it down. But, I'd have to look at the numbers. but there are programs. They're not as old as the ones in Asia. The ones in Asia, I mean, just the one I'm most familiar with is Grameen. I've been there three times, been out and gone with the bank workers out to the villages, met with the women, talked to them about their experiences. And these are the poorest. In order to get a loan, you have to prove that you are the poorest in the community. In fact, I'll tell you a long story maybe afterwards. But we don't have much time. But it does work for people who have nothing. These people have skills. They know how to do something, or else they wouldn't still be there. So the kinds of activities these women are doing with their families are things like buying a cow and then selling the milk. The simplest one is buying rice paddy and then just working with it and then selling the rice. Other things, raising chickens. Very basic things that these people have these skills, the person making the bamboo stools, but they just need the capital. I think that there's always going to be people who are not as wealthy as others. There'll be people who are the poorest in the community. The question for me is, will everyone be able to meet their basic needs? And microcredit is just such a wonderful solution to that, because these people are able to feed themselves better, clothe themselves better, educate their kids, provide a better life for their children. There are just tons of stories I could tell you about how families have been changed for generations because of small loans. I'm not worried about making a class system worse by providing opportunity for people. Well, I loved Rick's talk. I mean, he came right to some very important points, and that is, are we about Band-Aids or are we about solutions? And boy, that's hitting the nail right on the head. That's why I like some of the things that I've been talking about, because they are solutions. Compassionate conservatism, I haven't figured out what that means yet. As far as our own society, we've had great economic times. In the past, we've pretty much depended on trickle down. And trickle down doesn't work very well. It doesn't trickle down very far. Maybe 40% of our society has benefited from this great economic boon. 60% haven't. Salaries, buying power is down. Average, salaries are down. Buying power. So not everyone has benefited. And so, I think we need to look at some of those. As the economy improves more, it may trickle down a little bit more. But again, that's why I love Eunice's approach, in that he is so committed to attacking poverty at the poorest people. And having been in meetings, where he's been present, people are always, well, those people, just ignore them, go a few rungs up the ladder, and that's, where people are capable. And he knows that if you don't attack it at the very poorest, they're going to be missed forever.
Can I add just one thing? And I know we're almost out of time, but maybe we're out of time. One of the things I didn't approach, and let me just push the envelope a little further. Not only am I asking us to consider what the church, what the LDS Church in Utah and Salt Lake City, for example, today, might do to address the causes of the difficulties we see in society, But I'd also like to ask us to think about those instances in which the church itself is part of the problem rather than part of the solution.
I might look to the Catholic Church for maybe a bit better of an example, and Catholics have over the years been much more open about these issues. So you might remember the very famous pastoral letter of 10 years or so ago. It's a book that deep, and it's an incredible indictment of this country's policies toward the poor. And that letter was distributed to all members of Congress. It was used by various Catholic parishioners to do personal lobbying. I don't think the church itself got into lobbying, but and I recall when I served in Congress many years ago working for Wayne Owens back there, was a staff member across the hall from us was Robert Drinan, who was a wonderful Catholic priest. Now the Catholic Church pulled the plug and said they didn't want the priest serving any longer in governmental positions about 5 years after that. But Father Drinan really spoke regularly in behalf of the Catholic Church on issues of poverty. I think in this state, the church is very reluctant because of the fly trap that may be. They're already accused of being too influential in politics, and if they start getting into that, that may be a problem. But I think nationwide and internationally, the church could probably be much safer, where the church is a minority, would be much safer in going out and talking about the gospel of Jesus Christ in terms of helping the poor, and maybe issuing things like pastoral letters or policy statements on where the church stands. I know that's very controversial, but I do think that we could do more as an institution. Gene, did you have a comment on that? I do. I find it to be one. Now, I know the normal boundary of church involvement in politics in this state, at least, is moral issues, but I find poverty, addiction, despair of all kinds to be a moral issue, and I think I would like to see the church much more involved in that. I'm not sure how the church, I mean, I can't speak for the church, that's for sure. But I do think the church sees its mission differently, maybe at this time in history. And the mission is to spread the gospel. And oftentimes the spreading of the gospel alone links the church more with materialism than maybe it would normally, because you got to use communication, you got to use travel, you got to use airplanes, you got to use the more wealthy infrastructure in other countries in terms of leadership in the church and so forth. So maybe it's a difference in what the mission and the church sees its role in the world right now, and maybe the missionary thing itself conflicts in a way.